This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
PBS recently broadcast the American Experience biography of Robert E. Lee, and Professor Irvin Jordan Jr. joins me live in studio. He was one of the featured historians. Professor Jordan is a 31-year employee of the University of Virginia, an associate professor and research archivist in the Small Special Collections Library, the author of 3 books, and I'm sure more on the way. It's an honor to have you back on the program, sir.
Thank you, Coy. It's a pleasure to be back on your wonderful program.
So tell me your general thoughts now about this new Lee documentary that you were featured in. Just generally speaking, then we'll get into some specifics.
Obviously, I'm prejudiced because I was a part of it, but I very much enjoyed being a part of that documentary. I was very pleased with how the questions were asked of me and the preparation that went into it. And I consider it one of the highlights of my academic career.
Now, tell me a little bit about your growing up and how you first got interested in Robert E. Lee. You are a Virginian, right?
I'm a native Virginian, born and raised in Norfolk. And during the centennial in 1964, I was in the fourth grade. And in that time in Virginia, when you were in the fourth grade, that's when you were first given Virginia history. So we were taught Virginia history. And one of the things we were taught was about the Civil War. And the hero of heroes was Robert E. Lee, not Jefferson Davis, not Stonewall Jackson. Robert E. Lee was the hero, was the man.
Yeah. And this was taught to you in elementary school.
This
was
elementary school at a segregated elementary school.
Interesting.
I've always wondered what my teachers thought when they were having to teach all this about the great and glorious Confederacy. And here we are, this classroom of Negro children, as we were at the time, listening to all this. And I remember being puzzled. I was pretty precocious. I was puzzled by what I saw were the complexities about all of this, the contradictions.
Yeah, you could see that at an early age.
Even at an early age, I saw that.
Yeah, and I would imagine there wasn't, in the 1964, not a great deal of African-American history taught in elementary school in Virginia.
There was not. The only African-American history we received at that time was in February during what was called Negro History Month, and we heard about Harriet Tubman. We heard about Booker T. Washington and maybe Frederick Douglass, and that was about it.
Yeah. Tell me your thoughts about the real man, Robert E. Lee, and sort of this mythical Lee that you got in grade school that we all sort of get, you know, in some of the textbooks.
The mythical Lee, of course, he was presented as a demigod. I mean, he was the pinnacle of chivalry, of nobility, of duty. He was the person whose life you were to emulate. And to me, it seemed like he was never really human until later on as I began my studies as a budding historian. I learned more about him. But the way he was taught in Virginia during the Civil War, he was at the top as far as who people were worshiping and heralding as a great Virginian, a great Christian, a great American.
Yeah. And what about the real Lee? In your studies, what have you learned about the real man?
Well, as most people, such as myself and other American heroes, the real Lee had his flaws, and he had a considerable number of those flaws. And this is not always projected, even especially here in Virginia. It's still pretty difficult to publicly criticize Robert E. Lee here in the Old Dominion. But he had his flaws, and there are a number of them as an individual. And as I said myself, of course, I have my own flaws as well, but Lee certainly had his share as well.
Yeah. What were they? Tell us about him.
One of Lee's flaws was that he held a very high standard of duty for other individuals. Not everyone is able to aspire to the same levels of duty and honor as Lee wanted, and he could be very harsh and unforgiving with his subordinates during the Civil War about being honorable and a sense of duty. He was also contradictory. One of his other flaws, of course, was about slavery. Lee always argued against slavery, said it was wrong, hoped that God would end it in God's own good time. And yet his actions during most of his life showed that he not only was a supporter of slavery, but he also was also a supporter of what we would call today white supremacy.
Interesting. And we're talking with Professor Irvin Jordan of the University of Virginia, recently a featured historian in the PBS documentary about Robert E. Lee. I'm curious, as you're watching this documentary on PBS the other night, What didn't make it in? What wasn't in the documentary that you thought they left out and should have been in there?
You put me on the spot because, as I said, I was in it and I was very pleased with it. It's just some very minor things. For example, there was no mention of Lee being superintendent of West Point in the 1850s. It's a very important position in the American military, even in that time. However, it was a position that he reluctantly took. He basically had to be ordered to take it. He didn't want to be bogged down with that, but he remodeled the curriculum. He put West Point's academics on a more sounder footing, but it was one of the few duties in life that he is on record as very reluctantly accepting. The really big surprise for me, and some other historians have written to me and said, why didn't you talk about this? And I said, well, they didn't. I did talk about it, but it didn't make it into the screen. I'm sure the other historians talked about it. There was no mention about Lee's role at Harper's Ferry for John Brown's raid. And it's a very interesting story behind that. Lee was home on leave when that happened, when John Brown struck at Harper's Ferry. Secretary of War contacted him, considered him the best available soldier to go and deal with John Brown. As a result of Harper's Ferry, this is when Lee really becomes part of the national consciousness of Southerners. They begin to look at him as someone that we could trust if and when we need to take that secession step. This is a general that we could probably call upon if we need to, because he cracked down on this fanatic abolitionist. And Lee himself described abolitionists as fanatics. Also, the other thing that wasn't discussed very much was Lee's tenure while he was in Texas. He was stationed in Texas in the 1850s. He wasn't particularly happy there. He spent a lot of time doing court-martial duty and things of that nature. So historians tend to kind of gloss over that, except those who are really writing these lengthy biographies of him.
Yeah. We're talking with Professor Irvin Jordan about Washington, Robert E. Lee. You can join the conversation at 977-1070. What are your thoughts about, we're celebrating or commemorating, recognizing the 150th anniversary of the United States Civil War this year. What are your thoughts about it? It's a difficult thing to commemorate when you're recognizing this point in history, 150 years since the beginning of this tragic conflict between the North and the South that killed so many and really had repercussions for the next 100 years, and some would say still is echoing throughout some parts of the country. What are your thoughts about as America recognizes the 150th?
As a prelude, I first must tell your listeners that it's incumbent on me to state that I am a member of the advisory committee to the State Civil War Assessment Centennial Commission. And I'm very proud of my participation in that. And what we're trying to do over the next 4 or 5 years is to arrange what we call signature conferences, which will be free to the public, and which scholars will be invited to spend all day talking about various aspects of the war. The next one will be in May at Virginia Tech. So I'm very proud of that. So I need to state that first. The other thing that strikes me about the Assessment Centennial is we're very careful this time around to get it right. The Civil War Centennial of the 1960s, blacks were pretty much left out of it. The dominant whites really didn't care what blacks thought about it. Many blacks privately protested about their taxpayer dollars being used to commemorate the South. But this time, Virginia is doing a better job. In fact, Virginia is the number one state in the country for commemorating the Assessment Centennial right now. No one else is doing it as well as Virginia is, nor in planning detail. We're number one in that regard. The other thing is that we're very careful to say that this is not a celebration of the war. This is a commemoration. The difference being that 620,000 men were killed during the Civil War, 350,000 Union soldiers, 250,000 Confederate soldiers. We historians estimate for every soldier killed that affected at least two or three other people, wives, widows, children, and that sort of thing. So it was a tragedy in many ways. So we're very careful to say that we're commemorating the war.
Yeah.
As opposed to celebrating.
And I guess you would say, as a historian, you would see it as a good opportunity over the next few years for adults and young people alike to take an opportunity to read a book, to go to a battlefield, to learn something about this period.
It would be a tremendous opportunity. Yeah. This is something the State Commission on the Assessment Centennial of the Civil War is trying to do. We're very conscious of that. The politicians in Richmond have been very good about listening to us historians and our ideas and suggestions and incorporating them. So I'm very pleased with that. The other problem with the Assessment Centennial is that so far we've not been able to get Congress to establish a national, federal Civil War Assessment Centennial Commission. Which is just shocking when you consider all the time and effort and federal tax dollars that were spent for the Civil War centennial in the 1960s. But there have been bills proposed, there are bills pending, and it's stalled in Congress. So that's something that is of great puzzlement to me, given how Americans love to commemorate their history. And yet here's probably the second biggest event in American history, and the feds doesn't seem interested in doing anything on its behalf.
And aside from the money situation, why would you think that is?
Because I think politicians in Washington consider the Civil War to be politically incorrect. They're concerned about slavery. They're concerned about pleasing all sides, people that are known as neo-Confederates who argue that the war wasn't about slavery, blacks who feel that maybe the war shouldn't even be commemorated at all. So I think the politicians so far have decided the best way to deal with this is to do nothing and try to ignore it.
Yeah, we're talking with Professor Irvin Jordan of the University of Virginia. He's an associate professor and research archivist in the Small Special Collections Library. One of my favorite book of yours is Charlottesville and the University of Virginia in the Civil War, which you wrote back in the 80s. And what do you think it is that most people here in Central Virginia don't know about the Civil War? That historians like yourself just, you know it because you've researched it and you're familiar with it. Mm-hmm. But what is it you're constantly running into where people maybe raise eyebrows and they're not familiar with?
Number one, Charlottesville was a Confederate hospital zone during the Civil War for the most part, with the University of Virginia being the focus of that in various private homes. And then, as now, University of Virginia looked out for itself, because the University of Virginia eventually sent a bill to the Confederate governor in Richmond for the bloodstains that were on the floor at the rotunda, and the soldiers that were being stationed in the on the lawn and everything. The university said, this costs money. Here's a bill. And the Confederate government basically wrote back and said, we're not paying, and where is your patriotism? And the University of Virginia said, well, after the war, after we won, the primary goal of this university is to educate future citizens of the Confederacy. So, we need to get paid, basically, yeah, is what they said. The second thing is that a very famous American military person was in this area during the Civil War. George Armstrong Custer was in this area at the battle. Well, it was more of a skirmish, but we call it the Battle of Rye Hill, which is where Rye Hill is now. And Custer was part of a diversionary raid. There was going to be a big raid on Richmond, and he was the diversion. And Custer came down, and he wound up engaging in a small battle with a very small Confederate camp near almost exactly where the Rye Hill Shopping Center is today.
We're talking with Professor Irvin Jordan, recently a featured historian in the new PBS documentary about the life of Robert E. Lee. Let me talk about the surrender at Appomattox. What comes to mind that you have learned in your research about Lee at this period, right at the end of the war?
Obviously, Lee was very unhappy to surrender. I think he knew as early as a year previously that it was going to come to that, because he said if Grant gets within Petersburg, he said it would then become a question of time. But he was very, obviously he was very troubled by the fact that he had to surrender. But also what is not generally known is, and this is my interpretation and some other historians have agreed with me, Robert E. Lee tried to snub Grant at Appomattox when he was surrendering. And this is how it goes. When Grant and Lee first met, Grant said of Lee, I've seen you, I've seen your picture, I remember you from the Mexican War. There were two snubs. The first snub was Lee said, I don't recall a single feature. I don't recall your face. I don't recall you during the Mexican War, and I certainly don't recall basically seeing your face. Lee said it very politely. I've tried to recall your features, but I couldn't come up with a single one. Well, we historians know that Lee avidly read Northern newspapers. He had a standing order that captured Northern newspapers were to be brought to him so he could read them. And Grant's pictures was plastered all over these things during the war. So obviously he knew what Grant looked like. I think this was a case of Lee, the aristocrat, trying to put a snub on Grant, the so-called commoner, as part of the surrender ceremony. So I think Lee tried to snub him. And in fact, after the war, about a year or two after the war, before Lee died, and Lee died in about 5 years later, Lee was asked who was his most difficult opponent during the war. Which general had been his toughest opponent during the war? He said George McClellan, not Grant. Now, granted, during his Richmond campaign, McClellan did get darn close to Richmond, closer than any other Union general would then, before or up until Grant. But he said McClellan had been his toughest adversary. So I've always interpreted it as being a slight snub to Grant.
Yeah, another snub. Yeah, another to not snub. Give Grant the honor of having been the toughest, even though Grant was the one that finally
got the surrender out of him.
Beat the army there. Yeah, mm-hmm. and McClellan was just making one mistake after another, even yes. though he did get close. But mm-hmm. we're talking with Irvin Jordan of the University of Virginia. Lee had 5 years after the war before
yes,
he passed
he had
away,
a severe,
right?
He had angina. He had a severe heart problem. His yeah. health, what is generally not known is that Lee was not in particularly good health during the Civil War years. Literally, as they said in the documentary, his hair went from dark black to gray literally overnight as his duties increased. So he had heart problems. At Gettysburg, he was not at his best. For one reason, Lee had severe diarrhea. And you can't show that on television. You can't show some guy running to the latrine every 5 minutes. But Lee had severe diarrhea. He had cracked his wrists. And a fall off his horse. Sort of
during the war, yeah.
During the war. This is just before the Battle of Gettysburg. He had taken a fall off his horse, and so he rode around Gettysburg with his wrist in a cast, and he had diarrhea, and his heart was giving him severe problems. So he was not in the best of health.
Wow. No, I had no idea. But he did end up in Lexington, right?
He ended up in Lexington. He accepted a position as president of what is now Washington Lee University, and he did very well there. The townspeople obviously revered him. The students revered him. And his relationship with both of these groups was very good. And what is not said very often out loud about Lee was Lee pretty much could get his way about things. I mean, he was Robert E. Lee. If he wanted something at the school done, it would pretty much get done. I mean, who's going to challenge the great and immortal Robert E. Lee?
Yeah, and so he did have an impact on the school.
Very great impact on the school.
And really
a
left
positive one.
It left a, you could argue, I guess he left a real imprint on what had been Washington College, now Washington Lee University, and created really a very, very Southern school that remains so to this day in some regards.
It remains so to this day. Based on his experience as superintendent at West Point, his West Point training, Lee was very concerned that the next generation of Southerners be properly educated. And he saw Washington College as an opportunity for him to undertake that. Lee received hundreds of lucrative offers, you know, just to be a figurehead and earn a five-figure salary. And he turned them all down to accept this post in Lexington. To me, that is a sign of his character. That is a good sign of his character as far as I'm concerned.
So he didn't cash in on his service.
He could have. I mean, he had a large family. No Southerner barely had two coins to rub together after the end of the Civil War. And he could have really cashed in, but he did not. He chose not to.
Yeah. So let me ask you this before I let you go. And we're talking with Irvin Jordan of the University of Virginia. Who's next? Who would you like to see the next big documentary biography made? One or two folks from this period that you think aren't getting enough historical attention out in the mainstream media?
You're talking 19th century or Civil War period?
Yeah, yeah.
I would like to see one. Does it have to be a Virginian or anyone?
No, of course not. Just to who you think it would be terrific fodder for a good documentary.
I think another person that would be a very good documentary as a civilian, I would go with Frederick Douglass. Now, here's a man who became the spokesman of Black America shortly before and certainly during the Civil War and during the remainder of his lifetime, a very powerful intellect, a powerful speaking voice. On two occasions while he was visiting the White House, he was mistaken for the President of the United States. He wrote beautifully. He spoke eloquently. Frederick Douglass, I think, is someone that we really could use a very good documentary on. If you want a military figure, I would say Jubal Early, but I don't think anyone's going to do one on Jubal Early because he was such a cantankerous character. And also Mosby, John Singleton Mosby, who's a fascinating character. He was mentioned in Lee's dispatches more than any other officer during the war. Those might be suitable, but I rather doubt that Early would make the cut. Maybe Mosby, definitely Frederick Douglass.
Professor Irvin Jordan of the University of Virginia. He's an associate professor and research archivist in the Small Special Collections Library. Specializes in Civil War history, the author of three books, and a featured historian in the recent PBS documentary series about Robert E. Lee. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed this opportunity.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.